Please note that after the recording of this particular podcast, Reverend Sean Lucas withdrew as a speaker for the evening of confessional concern and prayer, and this will affect the first portion of the podcast. Thank you.
Edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. As usual, I am your host, William Hill, and this is broadcast 81, March 12th, 2015. Today we're going to be talking with two men who have began last year a particular thing. They'll explain that in a minute. But it's something that PCA, members in the PCA, both teaching and ruling elders, can take advantage of before each General Assembly. It's something that began last year and is continuing this year. It's called an evening of confessional concern and prayer, and I think both men would agree that the underscore there is prayer. And so we're going to be talking with Pastor Jeff Gleason and Pastor Ken Pierce, both teaching elders in the Presbyterian Church in America, in just a few minutes about that particular subject. Let me just really fast, everybody knows this stuff anyway, but if you're interested in more information about the seminary, you can find that at our website, gpts.edu, as well as the podcast, confessingourhope.com. Additionally, we've begun rolling out a new website for Dr. Piper, where much of his material and resources and writing is available free, as of course, and that is Joseph Piper.com. So those are some resources, information that most people who listen to this podcast already knew, I'd say, anyway, and know all about it. Now, as I indicated, we're going to be talking with Pastor Gleason and Pastor Pierce about this evening of confessional concern and prayer. Last year, about this time, we did a podcast to try to highlight and promote this work, this effort that they've put together. And so, guys, it's great to have you back on again to talk through this particular thing that you've started, last year, I think, and maybe one of you can give the listeners, how did this actually begin? I mean, what was the genesis of it? I know you've done it once, and but how did it actually begin then, and how has it come together this year? Maybe give some specifics as to date, time, location, why and where, that kind of stuff. So I don't care who does it. There's both guys on, so it's going to be interesting, but do the best you can, and we'll just have fun.
Go ahead, Jeff.
All right.
He's punting already. See that?
That's
see
right.
I want to first thank you for having us on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to people about the evening of confessional concern and prayer. It's this second year, so it's almost tradition now. Since we're Presbyterian, we have to do it twice, and then it's a tradition. But what happened at the start of it was Ken and I were having a phone call. At one point about, I don't know, Ken, I interned under Ken when I was at seminary at RTS Jackson. And so I call Ken from time to time just to make sure the ship's going in the right direction still. We were talking about different things, and we had mentioned some of the concerns that we had had about developments within the PCA. And I think it was, if I remember correctly, that we kind of agreed that instead of just talking about it, we should see if we could come together in a constructive way, talk about some of the issues that are of concern to people on, for lack of a better term, on the conservative side of the aisle within the PCA, but not just leave it there, also spend time in prayer together since we seek to do things only by the Lord's help. And then we had spoken following that initial phone conversation. We talked briefly with Mel Duncan, a ruling elder at Second Pres in Greenville, and also Rick Phillips, who's the teaching elder there. And we apparently were providentially thinking the same kinds of things, and so we've partnered up with them doing this work, hopefully to support the commissioners who are coming to the General Assembly as they prepare for the important decisions that are made in a church court. And so it was intended to be something that was an encouragement rather than something that's divisive. And So we've had one under our belts now, and you really do have the advantage of seeing one play itself out. And what we realized was, or from my perspective anyways, one of the things I realized was the strength of that hour of prayer that we had together in that room with all those teaching and ruling elders gathered together. You know, when you have time of prayer, it's something that settles, and it's something that really gives peace in the soul prior to a meeting that can be disconcerting at times. Mm-hmm. And I thought, in terms of looking back, yeah, the talks were beneficial, and I think they were very helpful. I think all the presenters did a good job presenting the material clearly and helpfully, so that you could see the significance of some of the decisions that were being made at last General Assembly. But I think in all, the highlight for me was that time of prayer together, where you had men who maybe on some things didn't even see eye to eye, at least not in all the details, but still being able to come together and seeking the Lord's face and living out that dependence on the Lord, even as churchmen. Sometimes you can lose sight of that. And I thought it was a good reminder. I don't know if you have more to add. I don't know if I left anything off, Ken, but that's kind of my recollection.
Right. Now, I think you covered it, but being a pastor, I've got to say something in addition. So, I think Jeff did a great job explaining it. I was thinking, one of the things that gave rise to it was, and I'm trying to remember the details of that conversation exactly, but that I felt like I had been caught off guard by the whole insider movement discussion, not even having any awareness of what it was. And all of a sudden, here it is at the General Assembly, and that if teaching elders who are fairly attuned to what's going on are confused, what's your average ruling elder who didn't have the time or the, inclination necessarily to keep on top of every issue going on denominationally, is coming to General Assembly not knowing anything about the issues that might come? How could we mitigate that? And I think that was one of the goals, is to be of service to the broader church, but to do it in a winsome way, insofar as that's possible, not backing down from what we believe to be the truth or an assessment of where we think things are in the PCA, but to do it in a winsome way, to keep it open so that anybody who wants to come can come. It's not a secret meeting. There's no caucusing going on. There's no behind-the-scenes machinations, even though some find that difficult to believe, but there's no organizing going on. It's just a meeting of, these are some issues that we think are facing the church. Here's something food for thought about these things so that you're aware. And then let's bring this before the Lord, because like Jeff said, we could plan, scheme, and do everything all day long, but if the Lord withheld his blessing, then it would be for naught. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, and I'm glad you mentioned. I know we last year when we did this, I think we went out of our way to make sure that people understood that this evening of confessional concern and prayer is not a secret club. It's not designed to kind of run an undercurrent behind closed doors, but it is, and as I indicated in the opening, it's about prayer. It's about seeking the Lord's face. He's the head of the church. We are under shepherds. We want to do what he would tell us to do, and do it wisely with concern, not only for the truth of the gospel, but as well as for the benefit of our brothers and sisters and all of those people that attend in the PCA, not just the ruling and teaching elders, but all the many thousands of members that are been given to fallen humanity, fallen human beings, to lead and guide them. So, I mean, I'm glad you said that again. That's a very important element here. Just quickly now, you've had this once, so what kind of feedback did you men receive, or did you receive feedback?
Well, I think we did receive some feedback. There was most of it positive. Some of it was critical, and we try to take that to heart and amend as needed. But the overall structure, we concluded just by observing and from the feedback, was sound. And so we're following very much a similar format as we did last year, in terms of having several men speak to some issues and then having some time to pray together with different men leading different sections of prayer. So as part of the evening of confessional concern and prayer. The last hour is reserved for prayer, and we simply pray through the ACTS acronym, you know, adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and supplication. And we have different men who are leading those sections, and hopefully it's edifying to the people. Ken said before, it's intentionally very open. And if your convictions are of a more progressive nature within the PCA, I still encourage you to come and at least hear what your brothers of a more conservative stripe are saying. It's always helpful, I think, to hear somebody else articulate their position. It keeps you from making straw men and from demonizing people that really are seeking to serve the Lord as best they can.
Yeah, that's a great reminder, and for both sides. You know, I hate talking that way, but unfortunately, it's the climate we live in, and we have to do that. But it's good for both of us to remember that it's important to understand what each other's saying before we critique it and deal with it fairly and charitably in this thing. Now, you did mention speakers, and so I guess I want to ask up front. So this is not a free for all. So you guys don't just have people come in the room and it's just chaos.
Right. No, we intentionally last year when we began thought in order to keep control sounds bad, but in order to keep some sort of civility and decorum being kind of the upper hand, we thought and for it to be a presentation of like thoughtful, well thought out presentations that we would assign the topics. And we try to pick people who have kind of broader recognition in the church by and large that are known quantities. And then when it comes to leading the prayer times, pick guys who maybe aren't so well known to do that. But when it comes to the topics themselves, to have them presented in a kind of a thoughtful, thorough way where a prepared presentation versus a kind of off the cuff venting session was our goal.
Yeah, that's good and it's helpful. Now, what would you say the balance is between and we're going to talk about these four areas in a minute, but the balance between that and the time of prayer, would you say it's evenly balanced?
Yeah, the time. So we have four topics. Have the men speak from 10 to 15 minutes on each topic. And so that's approximately an hour. I mean, keep in mind they're all teaching elders, so they're prone to going overtime.
That never happens.
The goal is that's an hour, and then to have an hour of prayer, and we do a little singing at the beginning, a little singing at the end. But that's the basic format. Yeah,
outstanding. Now, we said it's not a free, you have said it's not a free for all. It is structured and it's organized ahead of time, so that it's mindful of other people's time as well. So the whole evening isn't just chaotically constructed. So you have, at least on the Facebook page, as you did last year, you have four areas this year. I don't remember what it was last year. I think it was five, but I'm getting old and my memory is not as good. But this year you have four specifically. And so I guess the best thing to do, just for the help of the listeners who may be going to GA, both ruling and teaching elders, you're all welcome to go. But to give them some kind of background as to the approach here, I guess the easiest thing to do is just to kind of step through these. I don't need to be exhaustive about any one of them, but just to kind of sort of whet the appetite, if that's the best way to do it. So
it may be helpful, too, just to think about when we had our conversation, put this together this year, we noticed that this is a somewhat of a down year in terms of overtures of controversial issues coming before the General Assembly. At least it was when we had that discussion. So our general thought was, well, let's take this opportunity to be a little more broad in our focus versus this overture that. Now, there is some of that, of course, but what is the, you know, so you have David Strain talking about the culture pressing in on the church, because David grew up in Scotland. He was a minister in the Free Church and so on. So he knows what it's like to minister in this kind of postmodern context where homosexual rights and homosexual marriage are more of a given. And so what is it like to respond as a confessional conservative Christian in that and as a denomination? And so too, like in the denomination as a whole, with Rick's observations of what he sees us as, where he sees us going, or what he sees are the particular tensions. So we wanted a broader, you know, kind of a broader issue base, for lack of a better term.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's good. And I was just thinking when you mentioned that it's kind of a down year, you know, we don't say that negatively, but let's face it, overtures tends to get the most excitement. Is that the right word? And I just wonder if because of that, the attendance at the General Assembly is not going to be lower. I don't know. I'm just, maybe that's the cynical side of me. Who knows? I plan on being there, Lord willing. But anyway, and I read that on your Facebook page. I'll admit to being a little disappointed. is that bad? Maybe it is. I don't know. But anyway, be that as it may, there are still things to consider, and there always will be. We live in a fallen world. We're not perfect people, and so we're always going to have issues to deal with. And that's really the first thing that you gentlemen want to address, and it looks like Sean Lucas is going to be speaking on the issue, the PCA, which you have a title as PCA Issues, and then listed them as SJC Reform and Related Issues. What do you mean? That's pretty broad.
Well, I mean, I think last year, of course, SJC Reform was very much at the forefront.
Yes.
And I think as a whole, I think what we're trying to remind the denomination of in our limited capacity is, you know, this issue, although, you know, it was voted down last year, this issue hasn't really been solved yet in terms of on a denominational level. So there seems to be a problem where we're setting up as a denomination, or have set up as a denomination, a very small group of a very small part of the body, which could potentially err. Not saying that we don't trust the men who are serving on the SJC, but man by his nature can sin and err. And to have very little recourse in terms of appeal, or in fact no recourse, following a rendering of a decision by the SJC seems to be creating problems. And you know, the whole idea of dealing with men with doctrinal issues comes to mind, that as long as their presbytery gives them a speedy trial and procedurally does everything correctly, how can we as a larger body of Christ still hold to account if, in fact, the SJC is viewed as erring or sinning? And so, not saying that the men on the SJC are going out with those intentions, of course, but as a church, how do we handle those kinds of situations? Is there a way that we could implement something so that there would be a way to address the decisions of SJC? And I think Sean Lucas, I listened to his talk from last year a couple of days ago just to refresh myself on that issue, and I think his plan is sound, or at least feasible. Maybe it needs to be tweaked here and there, but to keep thinking through that issue as conservative, a confessional churchman in the PCA, how do we fix what seems to be a potentially potentially harmful problem in our polity procedures? As dry as that sounds, I think it's still it's a relevant issue to think through and to ask that question: who holds SJC accountable?
Yep. You know, it's funny you bring that up, because I was just reflecting on my licensure exam when I was in committee, and one of the questions they asked me, and this kind of really speaks to what you're talking about, they asked me if there was anything in the BCO I could change, what would it be? And I didn't hesitate. I said, Chapter 15. And they were like, what? What's that? I mean, they were all digging out their BCOs, because they didn't expect that at all. I'm sure that wasn't even in their radar. And they were all digging out their BCOs to see what does Chapter 15 have to do with. And this is one of the issues. I was on overtures a couple of years ago when that was the issue. There was four different overtures related to the SJC, its involvement, how the assembly responds to their decisions, and the rules that have boxed us into certain circumstances. And how do we get past this? And none of the men on the committee, and with all due respect to them, they didn't even either understand what I meant by Chapter 15, or I don't know what they were thinking, but I know they dug their BCOs out. That was, it was interesting to me.
Yeah.
I guess they expected something else.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult because, and this is why I think it's valuable for Sean to come talk to us about this. I mean, conservatives can differ over how or what ought to be reformed. And we saw that last year because Sky sure. Waters was presenting yep. on a different topic, but he asked if he might respond to Sean, and he made the case for the way things are now, I believe. But there's a sense, I think the federal vision showed us, there's a sense in which our polity is schizophrenic and broken. It's schizophrenic yep. because you have a whole denomination that in Memphis votes some overwhelming percentage to receive a study committee report that denounces the FV, right? And then when it comes to individual FV ministers, we pretty much determine that, you know, either the FV really doesn't exist, that nobody actually really believes it, or that somehow we're going to tolerate this thing that we've already declared to be out of accord. In a sense, not a creedal sense, but in a sense with the study committee report with the gospel. And it just woke up a lot of people, I think, to how the grassroots system of church courts, the weakness of that, if a presbytery decides to kind of close ranks around one of its ministers but does everything procedurally correct, there's very little that anybody right, exactly. from outside can do or above. That's right. You know, so.
Yeah, the rules have boxed us in. And I commend the SJC for playing by the rules, as it were, but the rules have taken away the power of the broader church court to deal effectively with especially doctrinal problems. As you both know, I'm sure, one of the more recent unpleasant issues surrounding this particular matter, I'm trying to avoid names, though everybody knows who I'm talking about, is no longer in the denomination. You're right. Aware of that, right?
Yep. Right. Yeah.
I mean, in one sense, I'm glad. In the other sense, I'm sad because we weren't able to deal with him the way it probably should have been done. On the other hand, I'm glad because it's sort of the troubling nature of that is now.
Well, in that individual case, I mean, and then they did. I was reminded the other day that there was a trial of a particular teaching elder in Siouxlands Presbytery that. Yep. The SJC sent back for that court to retry. So, well, I mean, there's still kind of lingering things out there, even though some of the individual issues have been taken care of by, you know, less than scrupulously biblical means, unfortunately.
Sure. Now the SJC reform and related issues, is there something else brewing or on the horizon, or is that pretty much
really? But I think that the related issues is kind of, you know, what are some positive steps that we can take to help SJC reform move forward? And it's not only to do with SJC, but it's kind of information flow issues and how do you make sure that the man not in the SJC has access to the information, but at least the summary of the case and rendering of decisions. And so some of it is kind of an information flow question, and that's
sure.
related to the SJC, but that's not the SJC itself.
I can think of one way of reforming the SJC, but I won't say it on the air. But I'm sure you both are reading my mind.
I can just imagine.
All right, enough said about that. But Sean Lucas is going to be doing this talk, and now are these four items, are you taking them in order as well on that evening?
Yeah.
Would they come in this order? Yep. Okay. That's a good programming note. Now, the second one is confessional issues. Now, it does certainly it relates to the first one in some sense, but there's two overtures, at least that you've indicated, overtures 2 and 9. So maybe for the sake of the listeners who aren't in front of a computer, most of them listen to this program probably running around there doing their jogging or they're riding a bike or driving to work. So they're probably not even able to look at this. If one of you or both can summarize what is overtures 2 and 9 talking about, and then maybe talk through this second point that John Payne and maybe tell the listeners who John Payne is. He may not be as widely known as Sean Lucas is as well.
Yeah.
So I just gave you a truckload of stuff to do. Sorry.
Who wants to do that one? You want me to take that, Jeff, or you want to?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Those two overtures, one coming out of North Texas and one out of Tennessee Valley, asking for a study committee to be formed to look at revising the confessional standards in regards to observance of the Sabbath, I think particularly centering on the cessation of recreation, right, on the Lord's Day. So And it seems to me that the general tenor behind those that movement, not judging motives or anything, is that that exception is so common, and it's held by such a plurality of, at least, of teaching elder candidates and so on, that we ought to look at it, whether it ought to be in our confession or not, which I think is altogether backward. I mean, first of all, I don't have some. Go ahead.
No, I said agreed.
Yeah, I don't have sympathy with that particular movement. But even if I did have sympathy with a particular confessional revision, first of all, a study committee can't recommend anything to the General Assembly, as I understand it. So I'm not sure what it would benefit, what benefit that route would taking that route would have. And second of all, it seems to me that's kind of a strange thing to say. Well, our practice doesn't conform to what we believe, so let's change what we believe. And I think there's a great danger in that, obviously. Not that the confession is not scripture. It's amendable for a reason. But on this issue, I think it's correct. Now, John Payne is pastor, church planter in Charleston, South Carolina. Before that, he pastored for a good number of years in suburban Atlanta. And he's taught at RTS Atlanta and so on, and spoken at several different conferences. So he may not be as well known as Sean or Rick, but we thought he would be an excellent one on this topic.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Lash, as I said before, I wasn't able to be at the Houston GA, but I did watch the stream. And at least I try always do that. If I'm not able to be there, at least know what's going on. And as an officer, simply for that, you know, for that, that's one of the big reasons, of course. But if I remember correctly, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, didn't this get bounced by Overtures, this particular request from North Texas, before? And have they not then responded to this General Assembly and amended the Overture in such a way to conform with what they were requesting? Is that how it's coming down?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that they were turned down and told to simply, if they had a problem, that they should make a suggestion as to how to amend the standards to accomplish their purpose, because the standards were clear on it, if I remember correctly. And I think you know what Ken said about the approach is especially true of that the second overture, where they don't even have kind of an explanation, except for their whereas statements, and the whereas statements seem to flow along the lines of, well, we don't practice this, so let's change the standards so we don't have to take exceptions. I think the ninth overture at least attempts to make a biblical argument for disagreement with the confessions and the larger and shorter catechism, specifically on the recreation clauses. But I think the issue is more so than Sabbath issue, and for me, Sabbath is a very important cog in the moral law. But apart from the Sabbath issue, I think that the question of is this the function of our confessions, like, are we approaching them the right way? Do we use our confessions to reflect our cultural position, or do we seek to conform ourselves to the standards because we believe them to be an accurate reflection of the Word of God? Mm-hmm. And so I think from a confessional perspective, I think we're asking the wrong question. Instead of asking, should we change the confession, I think the better question to ask is, how is it that we have gone off course with the confession? Now, Kent said, that the confessions are not scripture, so they are open to be changed. But I think to move those fence posts on the confessions, I think that requires a lot more introspection than we've thrown at this issue. I think there's got to be a lot more self-examination within the denomination on this issue.
Yeah. So if I were to summarize, I mean, you guys certainly respond to this. The issue then for the recreation clause, as it's commonly understood, and because so many men, as it were, I don't even know what that means. I mean, what does that mean? What percentage of Presbyterians and men that come are ordained in those presbyteries actually take exception to this. I don't know what those numbers are. Maybe somebody does. I don't know what they are. But they seem to be asserting that a great number of their men, anyway, in their little presbytery, whatever it is, out of the 81 other presbyteries, are taking this exception. So therefore, then, because it happens so often, let's change the confession to agree more with our practice. But as I think you've said, that's upside down, really, right? If the Bible doesn't advocate this position, then yes, let's change it. Absolutely, I totally agree.
Right.
But if it does advocate this position, then we shouldn't change it.
Correct.
Regardless exactly. of what we're doing.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think that's – and that ought to be with any confessional revision, which myself, I can't imagine anything in the confession needing to be changed wholesale. I can imagine particular instances where it might need to be added to because it doesn't address a particular topic. I mean, I think that's probably what was in view in making it amendable in the first place. Not that we would shuttle particular fundamentals of the Reformed faith, but and one that's often brought up is, you know, abortion, right? Because it just wasn't in the cultural cards when the confession was written. Sure. And now, should we? I'm not advocating that we should, but it's just an example of something that could be added at a certain point.
Well, so let's gameplay this then. I mean, you guys are churchmen. I already know the answer to this question before I ask it, but the listeners probably will not know. Let's just gameplay this. The Overture Committee gets this. They recommend to the General Assembly to adopt this overture, and so a study committee is erected. What's the timeline on that?
That's a good question. Let me just think about that.
I think it was I think they said a year, but I read it weeks ago. So
yeah.
Lots has happened since
it's
then.
It's in the administrative committee report, and I read it, but I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head. So,
well, let's just say that it was a year. They come back to the 44th General Assembly? Yeah, 44th next year, not this one coming up next month, but the one after that. And they recommend at GA that we amend the confession to eradicate the recreation clause of Westminster 21. So what then? What has to happen for that to be done?
For it to actually be eradicated,
yeah.
It's, for it to be this is a Presbytery exam, William. I'm trying to remember, but I think it's 3/4 of the General Assembly. I mean, it's a super majority of the presbyteries and a General Assembly and a subsequent General Assembly. I can look it up. I have my BCO right here. While I'm looking it up, talk about something else.
Well, but, you're right. Before you look it up, yeah, it would be a super majority of that GA. Then it would take a supermajority of the presbyteries, and then another supermajority of this following General Assembly. Now, I mean, I'm a cynical guy, but I got to tell you, I find that almost beyond even reasonable to think that 3/4 of the 81 presbyteries would vote for this, and two previous and subsequent GA would do it too. I know the PCA is off the rails in some ways, but I'm not sure that we're there yet.
Right, and I think
maybe I'm wrong, but
no, I think you're right, and I think part of it is just a general reticence not to tamper with the confession. People say we don't need to change it, right? There's already an apparatus in place if you disagree with that particular clause for your presbytery to determine whether or not that's an allowable exception. So I think just that kind of inertia would be enough to keep it from passing. But then again, as you look at how things have happened in other denominations. History is not determinative, but it can instruct here. Mm-hmm. The reason, you know, a ball starts rolling at some point. And that's where I think people, well, we're just going to broach this idea. We're just going to get it out there for discussion. And then we'll see if we can make it, you know, kind of build a groundswell for it, not expecting the first time to pass. So that would be my thought. I don't think it's got a prayer. I don't really think it'll come out of committee, but
probably not.
I'd be wrong about that.
Yeah, it didn't make it.
Then you also have that other purpose of what we're doing on that evening, the evening confession of concern and prayer, is not only to deal with issues in a short-sighted way, but to take time to talk about these things openly and to make sure we understand the significance of perhaps something that I think each generation loses sight and has its own weaknesses. And what is our weakness as a generation? Maybe it's how we react to the confessional statements that we've been blessed with. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And I think you guys have already said this, and so we're just rehashing this in some sense, but the underlying concern I would have with these two overtures is not so much, yes, I completely agree with the recreation clause. I was asked in my licensure exam on the floor if I take any exceptions to the standards. I said no. I expected pushback from that. Frankly, I did. Yeah. I thought somebody was going to challenge me, and yeah. Nobody did. And I was thankful for that because I didn't want to stand up there for another 20 minutes trying to explain why I don't. But I guess the underlying concern I would have is the methodology that this overture sprang from.
Right. But in all fairness to Overture 9, they do make a biblical – or they try to make a biblical yes. argument for
good.
The changes to the standards. And so they're – but Overture 2 has nothing of that, but Overture 9 does make an attempt to include some biblical rationale for why they're doing what they're doing. And it's based mostly around an understanding of Isaiah 58, turning your feet mm-hmm. aside from your own pleasures and delighting in the Lord on the Lord's day. And so they make their argument based around that. I'm going to disagree with where they end up on it, but at least they're making an effort to justify their position from Scripture.
And I think my gut feeling is that the committee is probably going to say I've seen this exception taken in Calvary Presbytery, I've seen it in other presbyteries taken, and I think this is just my gut. I have no prophetic gifts whatsoever in this area, but I think. They may just say, look, the presbyteries are fully able to determine these types of exceptions. This has been an exception that some presbyteries will allow and some will not, and we should leave it in their hands. That's it.
Right. I think you're right.
I just don't see it becoming a denomination-wide issue of trouble. But maybe I could be wrong. Weirder things have happened, as has already been pointed out. So those are the two – I lost my page. Oh, I know why I lost my page. There it is. Okay.
We're all scrambling for the BCO after your tough question.
Sorry about that. don't interpret that as me being an expert in anything. I'm just I'm really good at regurgitating what everybody else tells me to say. So that's those are the two overtures of substance, I guess. I mean, not to denigrate the other ones. I don't even know what they are, frankly. So but those are the two that will be discussed. And again, I think those are the core matters to consider. Now, you got the third item here, PCA trajectory. Now, that I read that and I think, oh, boy, where's the PCA going? Where is it going? Who's going to be talking on this now? Because I know I can read. I would love to be there to hear this, frankly. But anyway, go ahead.
Rick Phillips is going to be talking about that one. And he's simply, this is a limited perspective, obviously, and there's certain things that seem to be cropping up in the PCA, perhaps leaning more towards a progressive direction. And I think all Rick Phillips wants to do is ask the question, are the more recent developments in the PCA indicative of a greater trajectory? A greater movement within the PCA from a more center, right of center towards a more left of center perspective of church life. So thinking about the influence of BioLogos in the PCA, BioLogos, an organization that is actively seeking to promote theistic evolution in the life of the church, issues like egalitarianism, are we rid of any talk of women ordination to the office of deacon? We had the overture last year seeking to allow men to take exceptions to having a conviction that women could be ordained. Have those things gone away, or are they continuing on? There are some positive developments, in terms of many people have had discussions with MTW about their recent changes and then revisions of their missions and vision statement. And I think those have been very positive developments, at least from a confessional or conservative perspective. But is there a greater movement in the PCA towards progressivism or Are we holding the line in as a conservative denomination? And I think he's just going to walk us through the things that he's observing, and we'll, I think we'll benefit from it. He is very clear in how he communicates, and he doesn't make you swim around the pond too much. He lets you know exactly where it's going to be. So I think Rick will do a great job with that topic.
Yeah, he doesn't lack in passion. No. He's definitely not boring.
No.
And you usually know where – yeah, you're right. I won't say anymore. I'll get in trouble. So in this – what's the goal really with that third element? Is it just an information thing, get people to think, or – I'm just thinking, okay, is this more information? What's the purpose of it? Is it just kind of like a State of the Union address?
Well, I think it's more than that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's just important kind of in a – don't put too much on this word, but a sociological analysis of the PCA, mm-hmm. Particularly because it is an interesting time. I always thought, and in some senses it's been true, that having a denomination slightly to our left, that's the EPC, served as an escape valve for some of this, but – I think I've been largely wrong about that. It seems like nobody's thinking, or very few would think, well, if my views of women in office change, the EPC is a better fit for me than the PCA. It almost seems like there's a motion out there to kind of change the PCA to reflect that. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
But at the same time, some of the more progressive congregations have left us. I mean, obviously City Church in San Francisco is in the news all over the place.
Yep.
Went into the Reformed Church in America, and not only went into the Reformed Church in America, it skated across the evangelical wing of that denomination right over to the left. And then there's a church in Reformed Church from Metro New York, too, that I believe joined the EPC. So some of the more progressive churches have kind of thrown in the towel. So I think it's important for us as confessionalists to realize, not that we're not involved in a war with people we disagree with, but if we there are some certain signs that are hopeful signs, I think, in the denomination, and there are worrying signs, and it's important to keep those in check, because I think the fault of the right is always, well, we're just going to take our chips and go. It's too late. We've gone off the cliff, and there's no coming back. And every time you do that, you lose, right? If you're just willing to take your chips and go home and not fight, or view that every particular battle is the equivalent of the war, and again, that's just an analogy, but then you're never going to win anything. And so if you keep, you keep your people who are farther on the right keep getting dissatisfied and going somewhere else, there's no hope. But I think what Rick will say, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth or predict, he'll say, look, all is not lost here. There are troubling things, but and there is a quote-unquote battle to be waged here. Mm-hmm. But we can hold the line. And like Jeff said, I mean, Lloyd Kim, the new MTW coordinator's responsiveness to the concerns of more confessional brothers on some of the matters concerning the MTW mission statement and so on, I think is a good and hopeful sign of that. I would say, too, like, remember the whole – and I don't want to get into the national partnership too much, but the whole flap when that came to light a year or so ago. And Tom Cannon, who's now the coordinator of RUF, who would self-identify, I think, left of center, was willing to listen to the confessional folks and come out and against his own brethren and say, this is not right. There should not be functioning secret societies. There should not be politicking behind the scenes. It's not right. So I think there are some hopeful signs, too, that need to be held before people who – like myself, tend to be pessimistic about the future of anything. So, I just think...
I identify with that emotion.
Right, right. And I think that's just a kind of a built-in character trait of people who are, conservative, and we need to be careful to mitigate that with, wait a second, we don't lose all the time, and Christ is still on the throne, and God is still at work. Why we don't just want to throw in the towel and leave without having fought the good fight.
Yeah, I mean, you remind me of conversations I've had with men who are still in seminary or very early in their ministerial life, and they're younger men, and I say that for a purpose and underscore that there's men much older who have been waging this battle for much longer, who are still in there, and they want to jump over and go to another denomination. I won't mention the ones that I usually hear,
right?
And they want to go because they don't want to be. There's too many issues. It's just too complicated. It's too hard. They've gone off. The PCA has gone off the rails here. They've gone off the rails here. And I always try to remind them. I say, well, look, you know, I certainly understand your concerns, and I realize that I can't bind your conscience on these matters. You have to prayerfully consider these things right. for yourself. But I said, I'm troubled by them too. I'm probably more troubled by them than you are. I've been in the PCA for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I said, but here's the thing that always sort of centers me a little bit. I said, I'll tell them, if every conservative guy that's genuinely concerned about the state of the church just left, where would the church be?
Right.
And they just kind of look at me, and I said, you know, in a large sense, the conservative, if you want to use that word, the conservative branch of the PCA is holding the moderates that are in the middle there.
Mm-hmm.
If without the conservatives, the tension of the conservative guys, the moderates are going to just topple over.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost that tug of war is constantly going on. And I said, so, you know, in God's providence, I'm in the PCA. And I don't like what's going on in some areas, but we haven't apostatized yet, and I pray we never do. That just try to, at least for me, keeps me centered. I go to GAs and I leave, and I'm thinking, why did I go? I'm just aggravated. But,
right.
You know, and it happens. But remember, as you said, we're not the head of the church. We're just to be faithful in it to the best of our ability. So.
Right.
And so I think that's a great perspective, you know, that given the trajectory, help us think through things, help us pray through these things more carefully. And in fact, you do these four sessions before prayer. So now it's not only is it prayer for the denomination and for the General Assembly, but it's informed prayer about matters that are in front of us. So, you know, I commend you for having this, but you do have the right guy doing it, I think.
Yeah.
I've had many private conversations, numerous private conversations with Pastor Phillips about some of these things too. And yeah, he's clearly thought through them, I think, very, very well. And then, of course, you have the fourth item. Do you have any more to say on that before I move on?
No. I mean, I think it's just a summary of why we're doing what we're doing, right? Not to pout, but
nope.
To be proactive and positive.
And be informed. You know, we're not Congress. We don't pass things at General Assembly and then we'll figure out what's in it after the fact. We should come to the Assembly or any court, you know, session meetings, Presbytery, the General Assembly. We should be informed. That's been one of my complaints, I think, with GA, is that we get the documentation way too late and it's too difficult to weed through. And now you want me to make decisions based on what I've barely looked at.
Right, with very little
deliberation. Not because I don't want to.
Right.
Yeah. Not because I don't want to. But because I don't have time, because I get it a week ahead or a day ahead. But anyway, that's another subject for another day. Maybe we'll get the stated clerk on. I can ask him that question directly. But number D, letter D, the contemporary issues that are facing the church. And I know we talked off air a little bit about this, but tell us who's doing this and, you know, what's your goal and purpose here? I'll just leave it at that. I'm sure this will generate conversation anyway.
Yeah.
Well, so whoever.
Okay. David Strain is the minister at First Presbyterian Church here in Jackson. He followed Ligon Duncan there. He was evening preacher while Ligon was still senior pastor there, and then succeeded him as pastor. And like I mentioned before, he is a Scot, and he ministered in the UK. He was pastor in London before he came to Columbus, Mississippi, and so he's ministered in a culture that's decades, I don't want to say ahead of us, but decades further down the slope, if you will. And so I think David will bring an interesting perspective as to how to be a faithful Christian within a culture that is post-Christian and therefore anti-Christian, that views or that we think or we thought was going to view Christianity is a private matter that as long as it didn't enter the public square could believe what it wanted. But I think that the whole homosexual marriage debate is showing us that that isn't true. I mean, that this is not going to stop at the doors of the church. It's going to invade the walls of the church and cost individual congregations and maybe denominations dearly for standing up for biblical marriage, biblical manhood and womanhood in general. So David will, just from his own particular experience, I think, and also, yeah, because he's ministered in a different context, he'll bring a different perspective than the one we've probably all just imbibed from talk radio. So I think he'll have a very unique take on it.
Yeah, and I think understanding not only the import of the issues in our culture and how that's going to affect our churches, but how do we respond to it even? When I was talking with David Strain about it over the phone not too long ago, he kind of said, you know, what's gonna make us different than the Pharisee looking down his nose at the tax collector and the other sinners? His definition of that word, and how, as a church, do we come alongside these people? Should there be some genuine repentance in their life, and they, through the work of the Holy Spirit, are called? How do we help disciple them and walk them through that process? And you know, when he was talking about it, I recognized in my own heart that's definitely outside my comfort zone in terms of, if we want to use that phrase. You know, it's not something that I've had to deal with, and neither would it be an easy thing to deal with. So what he's trying to do also, and not only laying out the difficulties of culture, as Ken was explaining, but also thinking through how do we as a church proactively prepare for those things that will become more common in our culture should our culture continue down this road of throwing off the restrictions that God has given to us in his word.
Yep. Well, we all know, and I'm sure the listeners are well aware of, at least in the United States, we have listeners in Brazil and China and Japan, so I don't know where their situations are with their governments and country, but as far as the U.S. listeners are concerned, everybody should by now be aware of the fact that the United States Supreme Court is currently debating or whatever it is they do after they hear all the arguments. But anyway, determining whether or not they're going to leave this in the hands of the states or they're going to make a unilateral declaration that that pretty much levels the playing field. So heterosexual marriage and homosexual marriage are on the same footing, and they're both marriage, and how that's going to affect the church, because it's going to. There's no way to avoid it.
Right.
Which really raises a question that's not necessarily germane to the particular topic we're talking about today, but I would like to ask you both a question. As pastors, and this is something that we've actually talked about in seminary, in classes, this has actually come up, but how can churches practically protect themselves from what we've seen already occurring with various businesses, Christian business owners who refuse to make a wedding cake, for instance, for a homosexual couple?
I don't, you know, that they're probably a question for a lawyer who knows ecclesiastical politics. Can you not foresee a time when we'll just have to surrender tax exempt status? That's a relatively small thing, I think,
in
the grand scheme of things, but it's coming. And things like incorporation and so on will probably go by the wayside too. Now, the question is, you know, will that ever be enough? The answer, you know, given what we know about history and how Satan works and reading the book of Revelation, not in any kind of pre-tribulational sense, but just is always no. I mean, there's never enough. Satan's never satisfied, right? So there's always going to be a place we have to stand and stand firm and say, whatever the cost, we're going to uphold this the matter of the truth of the Word of God on this particular issue. Yeah, I think I had another thought, but it's flown out of my head. Anyway.
And I think to, as pastors, set before the congregation the significance of prayer in response to this issue. Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely things we need to do for protection or whatever. And Ken knows way more about that than I do, apparently, from his answer.
I don't know.
But I do think that you got to start with prayer. You got to start with laying that issue before the Lord and just pleading with him for his protection over his church. And if in his providence he says, no, you have to suffer that for this time, just believe that what it says in Scripture, that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope doesn't put us to shame. So it's not as it's not as bleak as it can seem at times if we keep that perspective.
Right. Yeah, we haven't lost at all. Just if the U.S. Supreme Court says, goes in the opposite direction, which we hope it would. I'm comforted by the book of Acts when I see the amount of persecution that went on in the early church and how the gospel flourished tremendously in it. If that's God's choosing, let's face it, the United States has been sitting pretty happy, and the church in the United States has been fat and happy for a long time, and we've been left alone. I mean, by and large, I mean, let's just be honest, we've been left alone. There's been pockets of this or that, but the reality is we've been left alone to pretty much operate however we thought was proper and right ecclesiastically. But it seems like, anyway, unless God intervenes providentially, those days are changing.
And, and I think we're going to face it inside the church, not necessarily,
that's a great point.
But homosexual marriage. But what about, like you said earlier on, and Jeff mentioned too about David, is how do you minister to people with homosexual inclination? How do you regard that particular inclination? And there's obviously a variety of opinion out there on that. I think there's general consensus in the PCA that homosexual activity and homosexual lust are sinful. But when it comes to a matter of how fixed is the sexual orientation? Does an orientation itself count as sin? Those sorts of questions are just starting to be asked now. Those other denominations have asked those before us. It's just a matter of, we're seeing a shift in evangelical, self-professed evangelical opinion now in the United States on this matter. And you're going to see continuing, I think, leaders in broader evangelicalism equivocate and actually shift positions on this particular issue. What's it going to look like for us? And especially, I think the cultural pressure in the Southeast, you don't experience this near as much, at least in most of the Southeast, Atlanta or New Orleans exceptions. But as people ministering in the, New York, Boston, Ivy League towns, on campuses, they are faced with this in a much more pressing way than we are. And the question is going to be, are we willing to forego any kind of cultural acceptance to stand for the truth of the Word of God? Or are we going to try to throw over so much ballast that we can try to keep the ship afloat culturally? And that's always the temptation for the church. How little do we have to continue to believe to be Christian? How close can we get to the culture? And just being honest, that's just the pressure that's on us. So, and we'd like to think, well, we won't capitulate to that, but it becomes much more difficult when it's, it's a matter of the pressing matter that you have to decide at that particular moment.
Yeah. Those are great insights. And I think, practically we were talking about this in class, this particular issue, and, we asked Dr. Piper, this is not something when you were pastoring, you even had to think about, as far as what if a homosexual couple comes to the church door, bangs on my office door and says, hey, we want you to marry us. He goes, well, obviously you can't. I said, well, obviously I can't. I mean, I would like to think that the Lord would give me enough grace to tell them the reason. But
right.
I said, but how do we, then they turn around and they sue us. Which seems, I think, proven at this point that they're actually doing that on purpose. They're deliberately trying to find those opportunities. Now, I said, how does a church protect itself? He says, well, look, number one, it's important for the sessions of each church to have a clear written policy as to who you will allow to use your facilities for marriage.
Right.
You got to have it in writing. And that may not be enough, but at least it's better than nothing that leaves you wide open to all sorts of attacks that, we need to be prudent and wise at the same time, seek to minister in that context. But I think you're right. I think it's not an issue that any of us have really had to deal with directly until now. And so I think this is going to be a good talk. I this is one that I would would like to be in on, especially if I had to choose just one. This one especially, because this really is where the rubber hits the road, ministerially, as teaching and ruling elders and the people that we're charged to care for, and how we're going to do that. Especially the more broader issue of same-sex attraction. I think that's even more complicated and convoluted.
Well, that's the one we're going to be dealing with in our congregations. And I think if there's any good that's come out of this, it's that an individual who is truly committed to Christ, who has unwanted same-sex attraction, let's say, is going to probably be more willing to seek help with that than he would have been or she would have been in the past. That's the only good side to this that I can see. I hope that's right.
Well, if anything, it's going to cause the church to think through this more.
And, yes, that's right.
And to deal with it in a God-honoring, biblically oriented way, not, not just kick them to the curb and act as though, like it's a plague, whatever. I mean, I don't even know. Like I said, there's no class in seminary. Not that that would matter. 4 years of seminary has been great, but then there's theory and there's reality. They do go together sometimes, but a lot of times you figure it out as you're learning. But I haven't had a class yet on this subject. I've had classes that relate to it somehow, but the fact is this is going to be in our face. Just like we do have a class at Greenville on Islam. Mm-hmm. It's an entire class just on Islam and the influence of the Muslim worldview, and why do we have it? Well, because it's in our face. It's a big deal, and maybe it needs to be a course of study within another course to deal more. How do we respond to this? I mean, as Christians, we have the truth, we have the answer. It's the gospel, but how are we going to get that to these people that already hate our guts? I mean, let's just call it, say what it is. They don't like us because we're Christians. And they know what the Bible says,
right?
Because it's written on their heart. And so, what are they going to do? They're going to hate on us. And that's how do we love them? That's the question. And so, I think that's going to be a really good talk. I could do a whole podcast just on this subject, frankly. But it's probably needs to be done more and more in future days. Well, we've got to the end of the four items anyway, and it's been I think it's been very good discussion. And it's really a taste of what this will generate, I think, after you have these discussions, which really prompts a question. After last year's, was there, to your knowledge anyway, or did you witness or observe more one-on-one individual conversations or groups of conversations as a result of the things that were brought up?
Well, I didn't witness it personally, but I'm going to just assume, because I'm optimistic by nature, that there were tons of them.
It's such an anomaly.
That's great. Well, it's always good to have one optimist in the bunch.
Well, I'll tell you what. One of the things that came up, I did notice people talking afterward and so on and making connections. Maybe they hadn't met folks before. And I think it does encourage people to know that they're not alone. If they may be in presbyteries where they feel like they're on the far right fringe and everything's stacked against them, to know that they're not alone is helpful, and that these people are not, that these are loving, normal people. And that also opened up a door for me for a discussion with a guy from the other side, where we just got together, coffee and so on, and just got to know each other, and we're able to talk through some of those concerns in a way without horns and without teeth. And that, I think, is also a helpful thing, because like you said, it's easy to caricature things if you're, if you're not face to face. And so we really encourage anybody from wherever one perceives himself to be on the spectrum of the PCA or to come and to listen and to pray,
Yeah, there's not going to be a separate seating section for those who don't agree.
Right.
like the old school Presbyterians in the North, where they shove the new side, the new light guys in the back of the room or whatever.
Right,
it's not like that.
I think, for Ken's point, I was joking earlier on, but, I think that time of prayer really is that unifier in that process. Even if you're listening to four talks that you think the guy's got it all wrong, when you come on your knees to the Lord together, it really is it was something to be part of last year. It was a real privilege. So.
Well, that's a great way to conclude with an encouraging element to this. And again, I think all involved would say, come if you love Christ Church and want to understand some of the things, both sides, that's okay. But the emphasis, as I said in the very beginning, is on this issue of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
The church is where it's at, maybe because we haven't prayed enough, and we always need to pray more. I mean, I don't think anybody would deny that. We need to pray more. We are where we are for lack of it, maybe, or whatever the case may be, but prayer, we need to pray. Prayer works. It does things. It accomplishes things. So says the scriptures. Where are you meeting? Because we haven't talked about that.
Well, we're scheduled to meet on June the 8th
okay.
at the Chattanooga Convention Center. Ballroom
That's
H.
A Monday? That's a Monday,
it's
right?
It's a Monday. It's in Ballroom okay. H from 7 to 9 p.m. And, you know, there's no reserved seating or anything like that, but we are asking people to RSVP so that we can know kind of the numbers that we should expect in terms of seating that needs to be laid out. And then also, I don't know if it would be possible. I know in the past on some of your podcasts, you've listed some information with the podcast. I don't know if I can include a link or the email address that people can RSVP to.
Yeah, I'll put that in.
Because there's nothing worse than somebody trying to spell an email address on when you're listening to a podcast and trying to.
Yeah, and they're probably driving down the road anyway, and next thing you know, they've crashed into a pole because they're trying to, because they're so excited about being there, they just got to get this down.
Exactly.
You know, they don't realize that they can always listen to it again.
Right.
But I'll give the email address for those who might be sitting at their desk. It's cliffwoodpca@cliffwoodpca.com.
Sure.
So just remember cliffwoodpca. That's all you got to remember.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah. And the at symbol. You got the rest of it. It's .com. So. cliffwoodpca@cliffwoodpca.com. So there's the information, but I will have that under the announcement when I release this on Friday. So people will be listening to it on Friday and beyond. That'll be on the website as well. So you can click on that. It'll open your email program. You can send, hey, I'm going to be there and can't wait. I'm all excited. I listened to the podcast and it just got me really revved up.
Yep.
Okay. Well, maybe you won't say all that, but anyway. But again, I think all involved would encourage everyone, ruling teaching elders that are going to be at the General Assembly, to take advantage of these things, and especially the idea that praying together as officers in the church, Christ's officers, praying together before Him, humbling themselves, submitting to His rule and reign. He is the head of the church, and it does. I think you're right. How can you pray rightly with animosity or angst or frustration?
Right.
You know, it's a great, great thing, and I'm glad the Lord has brought this together last year, now this year, and Lord willing, in years to come, perhaps it'll be one of the ways, at least, that the Lord helps all of us think through some of these things more clearly. Any concluding remarks from either one of you esteemed gentlemen?
No, I mean, for me, I just would love to see as many people as possible come, and I just pray and trust that the Lord will use it for His own glory.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments?
No, I think we've covered it all. No.
Yeah, and then some. And then some, as
that's right.
As podcasts are want to do, tend to do, they get a little tangential, but that's okay. It keeps things exciting and informative and moving along. So, but gentlemen, I appreciate your time, and I know you're busy pastors, but we're also on this side at seminary level at Greenville Seminary, and what we're trying to do there, very confessional Presbyterian school. People know where we stand. It's not a secret. But we're really excited about this as well and glad to help promote this in the right sense of that word promote, but put the word out and get the information in people's hands. You know, they may not have Facebook, so they don't know. They're probably better off if they don't. So I know you're both on Facebook, so am I. Sometimes I wish I wasn't. Anyway, but that's another subject for another day. But thank you, gentlemen, for being on, and I do appreciate the answers in talking about this subject.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
You bet. Hold on the line just a second. Let me just wrap things up. Normally at this point in the discussion, I'll tell people what's coming up, and I usually also say, I have no idea. So if you want to know, like I want to know, go to the website, confessingyourhope.com, and usually I have the list updated as to what to expect in weeks ahead. We're coming into the summer months, and that means less school for me, and I can give more attention to this on top of other things, but I can give more attention to it. And so look for some very good discussions. Just for instance, I'll be talking with Ryan McGraw on a little booklet he put out on corporate prayer and preaching and how they relate and go together. I read it just the other day and was very encouraged and edified by it. So I'll be talking with him on that subject, and I have other things in the works. So the website is really the best place to get the information, confessingourhope.com. So until then, whenever that then is, we do thank you for listening to this particular edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary, and God bless.